So, Maharaj, I see you sitting in your son's house, waiting for lunch to be served. And I wonder if the content of your consciousness is similar to mine, or partly different, or totally different. Are you hungry and thirsty as I am, waiting rather impatiently for the meals to be served, or are you in a altogether different state of mind?
There is not much difference on the surface, but very much in its depth. You know yourself only through the senses and the mind. You take yourself to be what they suggest. Having no direct knowledge of yourself, you have mere ideas. All mediocre, secondhand, by hearsay. Whatever you think you are, you take it to be true. The habit of imagining yourself perceivable and describable is very strong with you. I see as you see, hear as you hear, taste as you taste, eat as you eat. I also feel thirst and hunger and expect my food to be served on time. When starved or sick, my body and mind go weak. All this I perceive quite clearly, but somehow I am not in it. I feel myself as if floating over it, aloof and detached. Even not aloof and detached. There is aloofness and detachment as there is thirst and hunger. There is also the awareness of it all and a sense of immense distance, as if the body and the mind and all that happens to them were somewhere far out on the horizon. I am like a cinema screen, clear and empty. The pictures pass over it and disappear, leaving it as clear and empty as before. In no way is the screen affected by the pictures, nor are the pictures affected by the screen. The screen intercepts and reflects the pictures. It does not shape them. It has nothing to do with the rolls of film. These are as they are, lumps of destiny, but not my destiny, the destiny of the people on the screen.
So you don't mean to say that the people in a picture have destinies? Right? I mean, they belong to the story. The story is not theirs.
And what about you? Do you shape your life, or are you shaped by it?
Yes, you are right. A life story unrolls itself, of which I am one of the actors. I have no being outside it, as it has no being without me. I am merely, a character, not a person.
The character will become a person when he begins to shape his life instead of accepting it as it comes and identifying himself with it.
So, when I ask a question and you answer, what happens?
The question and the answer both appear on the screen. The lips move, the body speaks, and again the screen is clear and empty.
Okay. So when you say clear and empty, what do you mean?
I mean like free of all contents. To myself, I am neither perceivable nor conceivable. There is nothing I can point out and say, this I am. You identify yourself with everything so easily. I find it impossible. The feeling, I am not this or that, nor is anything mine, is so strong in me that as soon as a thing or a thought appears, there comes at once the sense, I am not that.
So, So basically you just spend your time repeating, this I am not, that I am not, I'm not that, I'm not this, I'm not this, I'm not that.
Of course not. I am merely verbalizing for your sake. By the grace of my guru, I have realized once and for good that I am neither object nor subject, and that I do not need to remind myself all the time.
I find it hard to grasp what exactly you mean by saying that you are neither the object nor the subject. At this very moment, as we talk, am I not the object of your experience and you the subject?
Look, so my thumb touches my forefinger. Both touch and are touched. When my attention is on the thumb is the feeler and the forefinger the self. Shift the focus of attention and the relationship is reversed. I find that somehow, by shifting the focus of attention, I become the very thing I look at and experience the kind of consciousness it has. I become the very thing I look at and experience the type of consciousness it has. I become the inner witness of the thing. I call this capacity of entering other focal points of consciousness love. You may give it any name you like. Love says, I am everything. Wisdom says, I am nothing. Between the two, my life flows. Since at any point of time and space, I can be both the subject and the object of my experience, I express it by saying that I am both, and neither, and beyond both.
Wow. I don't know. I mean, you make all these extraordinary statements about yourself. What makes you say those things? What do you mean by saying that you are beyond space and time?
You ask and the answer comes. I watch myself. I watch the answer and I see no contradiction. It is clear to me that I am telling you the truth. It is all very simple. Only you must trust me that I mean what I say, that I am very serious. As I told you already, my guru showed me my true nature and the true nature of the world. Having realized that I am one with and yet beyond the world, I became free from all desire and fear. I did not reason out that I should be free. I found myself free, unexpectedly, without the least effort. This freedom from desire and fear remained with me since then. Another thing I noticed was that I do not need to make an effort. The deed follows the thought, without delay and friction. I have also found that thoughts become self-fulfilling. Things would fall in place smoothly and rightly. The main change was in the mind. It became motionless and silent, responding quickly, but not perpetuating the response. Spontaneity became a way of life. The real became natural, and the natural became real. The real became natural, and the natural became real. And above all, infinite affection, love, dark and quiet, radiating in all directions, embracing all, making all interesting and beautiful. Making all interesting and beautiful, significant and auspicious.
We are told that various yogic powers arise spontaneously in a man who has realized his own true being. What is your experience in these matters?
Man's fivefold body, physical, mental, etc., has potential powers beyond our wildest dreams. Not only is the entire universe reflected in man, but also the power to control the universe is waiting to be used by him. The wise man is not anxious to use such powers except when the situation calls for them. He finds the abilities and skills of the human personality quite adequate for the business of daily living. Some of the powers can be developed by special training, but the man who flaunts such powers is still in bondage. The wise man counts nothing as his own. When at some time and place some miracle is attributed to some person, he will not establish any causal link between the events and people, nor will he allow any conclusions to be drawn. All happens as it happens because it had to happen. Everything happens as it does because the universe is as it is.
Well, put like that, the universe does not really seem like a happy place to live in. Why is there so much suffering?
Pain is physical, suffering is mental. Beyond the mind, there's no suffering. Pain is merely a signal that the body is in danger and requires attention. Similarly, suffering warns us that the structure of memories and habits, which we call the person, is threatened by loss or change. Pain is essential for the survival of the body, but none compels you to suffer. Suffering is due entirely to clinging or resisting. Suffering is due entirely to clinging or resisting. It is a sign of our unwillingness to move on, to flow with life. As a sane life is free of pain, so is a saintly life free from suffering.
Yeah, but at the same time, nobody has suffered more than saints.
Did they tell you? Or do you say so on your own? The essence of saintliness is total acceptance of the present moment. Harmony with things as they happen. A saint does not want things to be different from what they are. He knows that, considering all factors, they are unavoidable. He is friendly with the inevitable and therefore does not suffer. Pain he may know, but it does not shatter him. If he can, he does the needful to restore the lost balance, or he lets things take their course.
And in so doing, he may die.
So what? What does he gain by living on, and what does he lose by dying? What was born must die. What was never born cannot die. It all depends on what he takes himself to be.
Okay, but imagine you fall mortally ill. Would you not regret and resent to some extent?
But I'm dead already, or rather neither alive or dead. You see my body behaving the habitual way and draw your own conclusions. You will not admit that your conclusions bind nobody but you. You see that the image you have of me may be altogether wrong. Your image of yourself is wrong too. But that isn't your problem. But you need not create problems for me and then ask me to solve them. I am neither creating problems nor solving them.
That's a very kind of meaty, pleasing one. I think you said last time that this was a good one. I agree with you. It's
Yeah, it has a lot of good stuff in there.
So, yeah. You've read it a couple of times. What is it has really, remained for you or struck you from this discussion?
The thing of the not identifying with the body. The whole book that, in general, that is something I'm really on right now. It's like somehow I kind of get, you know, somehow it's just like when he talks about not identifying with the body, it's pretty seductive to identify with the body because of the super feedback from our senses, like visual, taste, feel, touch, feel, you know. So like that's it's interesting. It's very subtle and it takes a, like, it's pretty advanced, like you know, even after all the stuff I've done, like I still, that takes, like, you have to be, I have to be pretty deep in the meditation to really like feel that and not have it just be conceptual. Like it's, you know what I mean? Like it certainly seems like we're in a body, you know, like, but then you remember.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost like you have to do some kind of mental jujitsu, or certainly some mental elevation, right? Because where he describes actually what it's like, what I thought was very interesting when he sort of starts talking about, this is at the beginning where he's talking about sort of floating over himself, you know, the aloofness and detachment, and he's kind of just floating. Where does he say it? I perceive, I'm not in it. I feel myself as if floating over it, aloof and attached. I mean, at some level, what he's describing there is an experience of dissociation. I mean,
right.
It's so interesting how, let's call it a potentially transcended or elevated mind, also resembles a traumatized, dissociated, actually quite unhealthy mind, because if you are, experiencing something traumatic, right, like you're being raped or something horrible like that, often people report that they kind of almost float out of their bodies and they're kind of just watching themselves because it's too intense to be in the body. And I don't know, I find that interesting because he's sort of saying, oh yeah, I just float above it all.
Yeah.
But he's not actually saying, no, I am very much in my body. I'm feeling it all. And I am able to stay with that. It's right. Because I don't know. I think that's the tricky part. Because surely once you're floating, you're sort of cut off. You're detached. You're not actually feeling the feelings of the body anyway.
Right. Yeah, totally. I think that analogy of floating, it's interesting. Like, I've had that come in my radar a bunch, of the idea of, like, out-of-body experiences and floating. My dad was just talking about it, actually. And he's kind of into it. And, like, you know,
your dad's like, into floating?
He's into the idea. Yeah, he had some out-of-body experience when he was young, I think not too far after an LSD trip, like within a month, so it was probably related, you know. And and he kind of, now he's getting old and he's like, you know, and he's reading something, I forget what the book is, but I was like, why are you reading that? He's like, it's talking about out-of-body experiences. And I'm like, it doesn't usually, like, I don't know. Like, I mean, I feel like I'm hoping and thinking probably, although, that he's pointing to a floating of subtlety. Like when I've had been in really, you know, felt really clear and not attached, it's like I'm not, I don't feel like I'm like floating out of my body. I just am there's space psychically or like in subtlety. Mm-hmm. So I'm imagining maybe he's talking about that, or I don't know.
Mm. Hmm.
Yeah, it's because people do have out-of-body experiences, which is crazy because it's like, it seems like that the eyes are part, that's actually part of what's been a little bit of a cognitive block for me is like, so I'm identifying with being, not the body. I'm the universal consciousness. Like, I can kind of get that. And then just if you're really present in the moment, you look and in actuality, you're just seeing some legs and some pants and, you know, but those are even labels, but, you know, your color and the hands, and it's only an idea that you have a body. But like the eyes, the organ of the eyes in any kind of conceptual thinking is what's even visualizing about anything. So how could you be floating outside of your body and visually seeing your body? It's a little weird. I guess, you know.
I mean, the thing is, I kind of hear these things and I immediately want to sort of, which is the whole purpose, right? You kind of want to, okay, road test them on yourself. So let's say I'm sitting here at this moment and let's say my testicles are feeling somewhat tender for no apparent reason, which they are. And so, okay, so I'm there's an awareness there. There's awareness of sort of some pain in that region. There is, and then there is also a kind of potential awareness, let's say, of a potential kind of mental pain, because you know, middle age, you start to feel pains, you start to worry, oh, have I got testicular cancer? I mean, you know, that's the kind of thing that happens, I think, with the middle aged brain. And so, of course, I'm aware of that. And of course, I can then, let's say, apply some of this mental jiu-jitsu and say, well, I'm not that dull ache in my testicles, and neither am I the thought, the sort of paranoid thought that any dull ache in my testicles is cancer. And so, but that that creates a dual state. That does not create a non-dual state, because the body continues to have that pain and the thought continues to reside somewhere in consciousness. And then there is also, let's say, this more sort of core consciousness or I don't know, self or whatever you want to call it, right? A kind of Maharaj that says, okay, yeah, but I'm not that, and I'm not gonna, you know, I'm gonna focus on this and not focus on that. But that doesn't really, it's really just like moving around the furniture. It's not actually doing anything, because I don't know if that makes sense, that, you know, because all of that stuff is still there. It hasn't transformed it. It's maybe slightly, yes, I mean, it's altered my distance from it at a sort of a spatial level, but it's still there.
Yeah, but like, I think it's sort of like, okay, so that's there. And then you're like, as soon as you remind yourself that you're witnessing it and you don't get, you know, and you stop being drawn in, and then you have the same, this experience doesn't necessarily change in that second, but then give it a few, you know, as like, you know, time goes on, and time, which is relative anyway, but yeah, if as the time progresses, you know, you start to, and then it happens again, this thought, you and then you witness the draw that's happening of that thought, and then you're like, okay, but I'm the witness in consciousness, and that's a thought, and then you start to like realize that that's just a thought, and that there's like also a room full of things, and you could think of anything else, and then the thought is still kind of tugging at you a little maybe, but then if you don't give it energy, it totally fade. You might even forget about it completely in like 5 minutes, maybe 10
minutes.
Oh, yeah, no.
In that sense, yes. I mean, it definitely gives you, it frees you up, I guess, to, it frees you up to experience other things. And I suppose, you know, I suppose for a lot of this stuff, right, in a kind of put it in a more modern idiom, it's a kind of cure for neuroticism, because essentially what is neuroticism? Neuroticism is that kind of, what was it, the clinging, the clinging and the, what were those two words that you... clinging and resisting, that's right. And that's what neuroticism is, essentially, right? It's clinging or resisting.
That's interesting.
I think you could frame it in that way. And this is, understandably, yes, it helps you to cling less and it helps you to resist less. And if it's all kind of predetermined, as he then goes on later to say anyway, so it's not really, you know, it's kind of the clinging, the resisting, whatever you do, you're going to be swept along by it all anyway. I don't know, I suppose, yeah, sure, I can see it making for an easier ride.
Yeah, I think it's sort of like the experience of being the witnessing consciousness, or the experience of being your actual self, like in the moment, like, you know, the reality of yourself, like right now, is actually like as the the kind of distortion of all the thinking and grasping and clinging and all that, all this stuff, as it, the more you're present and you let go of those different thoughts, like you basically, like the real you in the moment is actually like really magical and contains like all kinds of depth, and also like is like has like a bliss that's automatically imbued in it, that, you know, so, and then so that experience is just like far more enjoyable than the experience of identifying with like a bunch of different contradictory things that include fears and desires. You're just all pulled apart and static. You have static in you, and you're pulled and like resisting. It's just like very unpleasant for your nervous system, I think.
Oh, so yeah, totally. Like, yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, the taking the witnessing stance, I mean, that has definitely carried through, right, you know, into kind of, sort of a core psychological strategy, I guess, for mental health. You know, I mean, that's really ultimately what, you know, what CBT is fundamentally. It's that in a nutshell. And then, you know, that's the cognitive part of it. And then the behavioral part is then acting, or usually not acting, right, on as the witness. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And choosing the actions that have worked in the past, you know, like as opposed to actions that are just coming from fears and desires and like crazy mind thinking, but like, okay. So what kind of gave me the results I want? You know, what am I going for here? What gave those results, you know, in the past? And then maybe I should do similar-ish actions, or actions that are geared in the direction I want, not just response from some sort of thought that is just, you know, there's so many thoughts. So like, I think it's like choosing the, you know, being in a place where you're choosing both the direction of your thinking, you know, and also seeing it as, you know, seeing it as somewhat made up, like not giving it too much concreteness. And then same with the actions, like you're choosing them, you know, as opposed to being reactionary to like 40 different stimuli.
The other thing that I really, really loved, and to me, this is, I don't know, it's kind of like a piece of poetry. It's sort of just perfect, this particular answer, right? And because also it's so sort of experiential, and I think it would make for an incredible kind of guided meditation. I mean, it is a guided meditation where he talks about the thumb touching his forefinger, and how you can kind of, you know, sort of play around with that, and you can then throw your consciousness, as it were, into the thumb. So the thumb becomes the subject and the forefinger is the object. And then you can kind of swap it round, and you can, I mean, if you kind of try it out, right. You really can sort of, it takes a little bit of dexterity. I don't know what it takes, but there's something very interesting kinesthetically when you do that. It provokes a sort of a meditative state, but it also does, it's so incredible in terms of how, I guess, it really makes that, it makes it a very lived experience of that non-duality of the two, right?
I mean, just so much when we put ourselves into a thing, it's incredible how much in our imagination, it's incredible how real it is. Like, that's actually really cool. I've been experimenting. So like, I've been noticing that a lot. That's obviously the main thing you're sort of noticing when you meditate, is like, thoughts. Oh my God. Wow. I was just imagining something that, and it's like, who was that? Oh, it was me. And then you're like, oh, who am I? And you're like, oh, wait, shit, I'm sitting here. Okay, so that was an imagination. Wow, that was just the imagination. And then it's like, so that imagination seemed really real in your thinking because you put your attention into it. And that, like, attention that's actually happening now in reality, shit or whatever, but, you know, the attention now can be put into all types of things. And then in our experience, it, like, goes into that strongly in our perception. Like, we really can zoom into our finger, our thumb, or our finger, or our imagined of a story that, like, the story seems like it's a real, it's reality, but it's insanely not. Like, it's reality is actually real. The story is a completely subjective interpretation that, like, looks real in your imagination, but it's, like, not realer than a dream at all. Where reality is actually has substance. The imagination of ourselves in the past, or of, quote unquote, according to the exact way we were thinking about it, and, like, with a ton of influences of all kinds, it's not real, but it seems real. It seems really, really real. You have to actually ask yourself, like, who was that? And it's like, oh yeah, it was me. You think it was actually you, but it wasn't. And you're like, wait, okay, so who am I? And you're like, oh yeah, shit, I'm actually here. And that was imagination. So funny. So tricky.
Yeah, it is a very curious thing, that sense of the past self and how it's kind of just a, yeah, it's really just a, it's just a few sentences in one's mind, and with a couple of visuals attached to it, right? Because it's there's very, very little we can really, really bring from the past other than that. It's all just now. It's all happening, unfolding, and yet, of course, that's where we get lost. It's like we get lost in the we get lost in places where there's actually there's very little there. Right? You know?
Yeah, we think that the story is the reality, where we can realize that the story of the past is not reality. It's a story. And it has tons of, like, it's not reality at all. But that we almost think, oh, if it's not reality, then how am I going to keep track of anything? It doesn't work that way, though, because even if you know it's a story, that doesn't change how well you remember it or anything. So it's like a funny, like, ego protection tool that's like, don't even think about that. It's just a story. It's just a made-up thing in our imagination, because then you won't even be able to survive. How will you survive if you can't you can still survive. It doesn't make that big of a difference. Like, if you know it's a story, like, if you know the mirror is a mirror, you're looking at it's a mirror, it's like, you know, you still see the reflection, like.
Yeah, no, very, very, very beautiful. I'm definitely going to do some meditating. You know, it's weird because I did quite a bit of Zen practice, but I never really I always thought about that kind of mudra, because, you know, the sort of traditional Zen mudra has the two thumbs touching, and I guess it's so weird until I say read this description this evening. I'm not sure I've ever sat in meditation and necessarily moved, kind of pendulated from the one thumb to the other thumb. It's always been about the actual feeling the thumbs touching, sort of being between the two, right? But there is, I think there's a lot of interesting inquiry that can be done in that kind of movement, in the pendulation as well.
Definitely. And I think even just in the whole thing you just said is actually something profound. Like, you know, how many hours I've done the same, so many hours of sitting with my thumbs touching in that kind of mudra. And it's great. I really like that meditation posture. It feels good. And I've never thought of doing that. Right. And that just shows how many options of perception are we having. Like, it's kind of like when you notice something somewhere that you've been a lot of times, sometimes a lot of times, and you're like, wait, that's been there this whole time. Like, you know, then within that, like the perception of that as a way to perceive your thumbs and compare them, it just shows like, you know, we like how many options we have in this seemingly is reality. You know, it's like, but no, I don't think so, because that's like a whole different way to look at that. You'd be having a very different experience if you were doing that. So, you know, right there is an example of one of a billion options that you can do with your perception.
I mean, the other thought I had in terms of just kind of, I don't know, a sort of a practice, right? A potentially useful practice. Because I guess, yes, I do try, particularly if I'm feeling a bit neurotic about something or anxious about something, I do try definitely to adopt the kind of the witness position. But something I don't actively do, but I think I'm going to try it in the next few days, is a very, very deliberate... this kind of almost like this cutting off, like almost taking, I see it almost like taking an axe and just going, no, I'm not that. I'm not that. I'm not that. Yeah. There's something about the negating, right? Which I think is, although it seems a piece, let's say, of the witnessing position, because it, in a way it creates the same... separation or non-attachment. There's something, I don't know. I think, well, I'll have to try the two. But it feels to me, just thinking about it, or just kind of thinking about it this evening, that there's something about the witness that I personally sometimes find, even though I am the witness, I'm sort of detaching myself, I'm stepping back. There's something. Just in the way my energy field is with the world, that even then I'm still, even though I'm being the witness, I'm still quite intensely, I'm still kind of attached, right? I'm attached as a witness almost. There's some kind of intensity there, even as the witness has an attachment. Whereas...
I don't know if that can, the witness, I don't think can really have an attachment, because it's like a witness is witnessing. It's not thinking.
No, I totally get that. But I suppose I'm trying to describe something that I just sort of perception, sort of at a perceptual level, right? Whereas I think if one actually goes, no, you know, as soon as something comes up and, but I'm not sure if this would be, you know, if this could be a repressive thing, but maybe not. But I wonder if when something comes up and you deliberately kind of push it away and go, I'm definitely not that. I'm not that. I'm not that. I'm not that. If that is, I don't know, different to that witness stance.
I think it's a little different, yeah, resisting something, you know, I think, pushing anything away. You could turn away from it with your attention, though. That's not resisting. You can kind of...
Yeah, no. Yeah, I wasn't necessarily suggesting that that if I was to do that, it would be a pushing away. But I'm just thinking about the difference between deliberately and very consciously detaching versus a more... a more kind of floaty, if you like, oh, I'm just here witnessing. It's all just witnessing. It's all just cool. Because I'm not entirely sure that works for me. I'm just sitting here witnessing. It's all just cool. The intensity sometimes of certain emotions and experiences. It's too much just to witness, whereas to actually say no, to make a kind of very boundaried separation in a way. I don't know. It was just the thought of playing around with that as a
that's cool.
As taking these two different stances and seeing which one feels more liberating, because ultimately both should liberate, but. Which one liberates quicker, more efficiently, and with less struggle, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. That's super cool. Yeah, I think what you said then there really did it, because it's like, yeah, if you can, like, a way to, like, as long as I think we're not, you know, resisting or clinging within the reaction, it's cool. Like, so yeah, like, you could be like, no, you know, that's not resisting or clinging. Like, if you're doing, like, if you're taking an action for your, what you're standing for in yourself, that boundary isn't, ideally, a boundary, only like crappy boundaries are resistances. Good boundaries are like, no, like, I am good with this way it is. And it's not like that resistance energy, I think, can be, it's not so ideal. Although sometimes it can probably, it could be like a step in the right direction in certain situations for sure. I love what you said with the, like, yeah, you said it in some way that didn't occur as any kind of like resisting something or like grabbing. You're just sort of like doing from your clearer self. Like, your clearer self is like, no, that is bullshit. That's not me. No, that's not me. Like, you know, because it's a big thing happening in our perception.
But it's not so, just the clearer self, because I guess the clearer self would suggest that even that self is attached to its clarity. Whereas, I mean, I'm suggesting as a kind of, I mean, just for myself, you know, which is, I mean, it's a very common practice. It's not like I've invented it, but yes, to apply that to absolutely everything, right? It's even to the thought of being, even to the thought of, let's say, you know, having that clearer self, because I guess the idea would be to try and essentially, kind of really cut off. It's like cut off all the branches of conceptualization, so that you actually then just are left with a kind of trunk of awareness, which is sort of what I think what, you know, any spiritual aspirant is sort of after, right?
Yeah, but the only thing is that I would say it could be a little careful. I mean, you know, as to any listeners too. I mean, I've just seen a lot of some of the more extreme approaches like that. That would, you know, ayahuasca or some very, very strong workshops where you're just like doing it all right away. I'm gonna cut off everything right now, and then like that is, it's very, very, it can be very traumatic. Like, you know,
do you think so? Even, I mean, just at a conceptual level, to walk around for a day. I mean, you know, anyone is reading this book, I think, has probably done enough kind of playing around with things in their consciousness to sort of be able, I think so, to be able to do something like that. But do you really think that to walk around all day long just disidentifying, because that's all we talk about, disidentifying from every thought, feeling, you know, all of the sensory stuff that comes up, do you think that could have a negative consequence? I can only see positive coming from that. Because it's sort of, I mean, you're doing that in meditation, aren't you? You are essentially disidentifying from things going on in consciousness.
Yeah, but I noticed that that there is a patience and gentleness for me, at least, like, that's pretty much critical in order to not have it be problematic. Like, if I'm too abrupt, I notice that it's not desirable at all. Like, I am very gentle and like kind of, you know, like, not overt about it. Like, I kind of like, 'cause it's taking place in subtle, so, you know, a lot of it's your subconscious you're trying to like shift, because that's where it's all filtered through. So like, I'm just like kind of, and your inner child is involved, and like, you know, and it like, it has some pretty strong attachments and stuff. And so like, you know, I don't know, like, you know, if you want to teach like a little kid, like, you know, a new habit, and you just, no, taking all their toys and you're going to now do this, you're playing the trumpet 5 hours a day, it's going to like probably like make them not want to ever play the trumpet again. I don't know. It's kind of like there's like a lot at play in our body. And for me, at least in my body and nervous system, I have to be really like gentle with the applications. Like all day I am saying like I'm finding like a phrase that feels like soothing, that's like, you know, I'm witnessing consciousness, I'm the witness of consciousness. And as soon as I start to feel like, I should, I'm like, no, just chill, it's all good, like, just, that's not gonna help. Mm-hmm. just be mellow with it. It's like breathing and being is what you're after anyway, is this like being, which is a sort of a nothingness state. So I don't know, like, when I've done bigger things, it doesn't actually, in my experience, I haven't gotten results I've liked. But I think some people, you know, do ayahuasca or do some intense stuff and they get desirable results. But I've seen a lot of non-desirable too.
Well, there you go. We will leave it to our listeners to decide which of those practices they are going to adopt. You can either do the very mellow, looking after your inner child work that Mark is suggesting, or you can go for kind of punk rock, bring out the chainsaw, lop off those motherfucking branches of conceptualization, disidentify from everything, and then propel yourself off into the stratosphere like Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj, floating above it all, just one with the universe. Oof. Right? I mean, the choice is yours. Red pill, blue pill.
The choice is yours. Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. Yeah. Totally.